Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another series of podcasts about music, IB music, international music, global music. I'm very excited and pleased and honored to have a very special guest with us today. Her name is Alex Shapiro. She's not only a very gifted composer, she's also a writer, a photographer, an arts advocate, and a very, very nice person. Her music has been performed all over the world. I had the honor and the privilege of meeting her several years ago at the Midwest Band and Orchestra Clinic in Chicago, Illinois, where I first came across her music and her work and the caliber and the genre of work that she's doing. She has a unique ability of combining live and recorded sounds and using multimedia in a novel way. Her music is hard to describe in terms of being a particular genre. I guess we simply have to say it's genre-less. And that's another reason why I thought it would be so wonderful in terms of IB thinking to be talking about genres and to be talking about new ideas and new possibilities and tearing down barriers. So I am very, very much looking forward to this podcast and chatting with you, Alex. So let's just go ahead and get it going. Maybe you can start off simply by telling us a little bit about yourself and your relationship both in and out of the music profession.
Pleasure to talk to you, and you've given me a very, very kind and generous intro, so thank you. I think the basis of my genre-less, and it really is that, I think you're spot on, my genre-less approach and boundary-less approach to the music I've been writing for a long time might start with the fact that I was lucky enough to grow up in Manhattan, in New York City, right in the middle of New York City, and at a time in the 1960s and 70s, when I was able to take advantage of all the amazing things going on in that city, live and in all genres, all at the same time. I mean, one night I'd be at the Village Vanguard listening to the top jazzers. The next night I'd be at the Metropolitan Opera. The next night it would be a ballet. The next night it would be CBGB's or Studio 54. You know, and this was the time when punk and disco were coming to the fore all at the same time, which is hilarious in and of itself. But I think that when you grow up lucky enough to be in a place that offers all that, and then lucky enough, in my case, to have parents that allow you the run of the city to just do what you want to do, it's kind of magic. The way I could afford this, by the way, I always feel like I have to say this because it sounds like a lot of money, but I babysat for $1.25 an hour at the time. That was the going rate. I think that was top rate. And not that I was worth it. I mean, I don't think I was that great, but I did the job enthusiastically enough to be able to save all that money. And at the time, standing room tickets at the Metropolitan Opera were $3. You know, the Vanguard cost me $5 to get into for two sets. I mean, I think for the second set, I just had to buy a beer or something. You know, it was awesome. So back then, I don't know if this is the case anymore, but back then, a teenager could afford to go to these places and immerse themselves in this. So that really was monumentally important, I think, in my view of the world, because I was in the melting pot, in a sense. You have so many cultures in Manhattan, and I was availing myself to everything that I could think of that was going on there from so many different cultures and styles. And I was writing. I'm not particularly well at the time, but I was composing. And so all of that would start to seep through, I'm sure, in my influences and in what I was writing. So it was sort of the perfect, happy artistic storm. And so that's my background, and what probably very directly, along with a lot of travel and other things I've gotten to do around the world, has probably led me to the kind of stuff I write now, which within one piece, I might be 12-tone and pop and big band and Lord knows what, you know, like all even in one piece, and hopefully in a cohesive way where it actually makes sense. But I'll take people on a journey that maybe a lot of composers won't necessarily go to all those places.
Was there a golden moment when you decided I'm going to be a composer, or it sounds like that sort of shifted, or was there a clicking moment you thought, yeah, I'm going to?
Yeah, there was. And this speaks to the power of teachers, the incredible power of any of us who say something supportive to someone else. Because when I took my first formal composition lessons one summer in Manhattan at Mannes College of Music. They had a summer program with a wonderful guy named Leo Edwards, who probably has retired there by now. But he was very kind, very, very good composer and very kind. And I don't think I was any great shakes one way or the other, but I brought him in music. He looked at it. You know, we did this every week. And one lesson, he turned to me and he said, "Alex, you have the gift of melody." And I'm sure he only meant it very off the cuff, right? It was no big deal. But I am 62 years old and I still remember that statement so well. I mean, if you want to talk about a seminal moment, there were, I'm sure, a number of them. But that was one of them, that when you get a little bit of encouragement, just even off the cuff, just a comment, it can propel you. It, and I think all of us have to be so keenly and beautifully aware of the positive power we can have over other people by just giving them a nod, just acknowledging them, hearing them, telling them something, you know, out of the blue that might make them want to keep going. And conversely, it's also important to remember if one is critical and non-supportive, the power of that and those harsher words as well. So keeping that in mind for all of us, and especially for educators, is huge. We have more of a profound influence than I think we realize day to day.
As you're saying this, I'm just thinking, I recently retired from my regular job as teaching. As part of my retirement, you get these notes and messages from students, really from all over the world that you've worked with, students from 20, 30 years ago. And you think, God, did I do that? Did I don't remember being that profound or that. And students said, you've changed my life and did this. And you never know what it is you said or your facial expression or so on. So it's
It's
very,
so
very
true. Yeah,
profound.
hearing from people and yeah, you never know. And sometimes, like if I'm doing a Zoom, you know, with a band or whatever, I'll look at, maybe it'll look like everybody's stone-faced and maybe I'm not getting through to them or whatever, you know, maybe it's just I accept that, that's fine. But it turns out then you hear from people individually, it's like, you know, that it just rocked them and the whole experience or whatever. You never know. And so I think it's great to go in with that attitude of assume that you will touch at least one person, you know, with what you say. And so be kind and be positive and supportive and let everybody, you know, find their path with support.
Alex, what words of wisdom would you offer any young high school student who likes to write music?
I would say first and foremost, do it. Do it a lot. Keep doing it and know that you can't do it wrong. I think one of the problems in arts and in education is a lot, especially in Western education, is a lot of times we're hearing no, or you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or whatever. And in art, there really is no should or yes or no. It's a matter of finding your way through trial and error till you find things that click and that they click for you, and they may not click for everybody else. And yes, it is important when you're studying to learn the standard things that one would be taught in music courses, let's say, or any art courses. But in order to find your own authenticity, you have to be willing and be given permission, both by others and by yourself, very importantly, to take risks and venture off to what you hear and what inspires you. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be writing the weird kind of stuff I write. You know, no one really gave me permission to do that. It just occurred to me, hey, this might be fun. Let's try this weird stuff. So I think my advice for younger people or anybody of any age, they could be 70 and just starting out, is take risks, don't be afraid, give yourself permission to express yourself and by doing so, be as authentic to you and the way you hear as you can. Don't try to sound like everybody else. Everybody else is taken. There are already a million other people who have their sound. Great, good for them, and that's awesome, and we want to support those people. But when you're doing it, there's only one you. And I think too many times students can lose sight of that and feel like in order to be validated, they have to sound sort of like what is popular and what is successful, what quote unquote around successful, right? And what is expected of them somehow. And if they have teachers telling them that, then I'm not a fan of that kind of teaching. And if they're telling it to themselves, the best advice is to let go of those messages. They're limiting.
You have a lot of contact with schools. You've worked in schools, you've worked with students and so on. You're involved with music education. You know the system, you know the ups and downs of it. What would you like to see in a high school music education program, let's say 5, 10 years from now, or even longer?
It's probably a long list, but I'll be concise. As concise as I can be, I'm quite loquacious. But I would say Needless to say, more diversity of composers and their backgrounds and the styles of music, because we're still not there yet. It's great to see in the past 10, 15 years, there has been a significant push and an improvement on what's on students' music stands, but it still is a very small percentage of what I would call, diverse music of the time, et cetera. So that's number one. And it's just a given that we have to keep working on that. Number two is, every student right now is entering a world, well, they're in a world, and by the time they are out of school, they will be completely immersed in a world that is very, very, very tech-driven. And while there is, traditional education never goes out of style, and the importance of learning the same lessons that people learned 200 years ago it remains. However, if we don't address the realities of tech, of AI, of the ethics and copyright issues of what it is to be a citizen in a digital world, if we don't address that with them early on, we're missing the boat, and we're not going to be helping them, because this is the world that we're all living in it, but I think a lot of older people can get by and have their heads in the sand a bit, because it doesn't necessarily affect them as much as it's going to affect an 18-year-old, or a 12-year-old for that matter. We have a responsibility to prepare the students for their future. And that means that some of us have to ramp up and really learn. We have to pay attention to what's out there. I think it's just very, it's our responsibility to prepare students in every possible way. And again, I don't see that happening quite enough in classes. And I'm not saying this just because I happen to write a lot of band music that's electroacoustic, or a lot of chamber music that's electroacoustic and thus a little techie. I would say it if I was only writing string quartets, that this is very, very important. So that's what I'd like to see, more diversity and more tech knowledge and education and awareness coming from everybody, the teachers and the students.
Yeah, as you're talking, I'm just thinking of sort of like a paradigm shift of the difference of what it was like for me when I went through my music education program of being taught how to teach, of being the one that is the band director, the leader, the all-knowing, the follow me, do it my way, to it seems like we need to embrace another type of approach to that. It's okay for a teacher not to know. It's okay to get into the unknown. You mentioned technology and so on. So I'll just relate this sort of as a footnote. Several years ago, my last few years at the American School, our music tech person he retired, and they wanted to have the music tech program, but they wanted to have it mainstream with the music program. So school leadership came to me. And they said, "Jim, we want you to run the music tech program along with the band program." I looked at them, mouth dropped. I said, "You want me to teach music tech? This is what you want? I hardly know how to turn on a computer, and now you're asking me to do this?" And they said, "Well, see what happens." And I just went into it. I took the courses, I delved into it, and so on. And I got into that course, leading that course. We were working with Logic Pro and music sequencers and all sorts of different programs and so on. And there were kids coming into that class that were, I just said, "Well, let me hear what you got." And they were going, "Oh," just making, doing all these connections. And what they were producing was phenomenal. Absolutely, absolutely phenomenal. I said, "Well, slow down, slow down. How did you do that? Tell me how you did that." And he said, "Well, it's just this and this." And so then I had to say, "Okay, do you know what that is?" I said, "No, just do it. That just sounds like." Well, I would say, "Okay, in music, we would call that a cadence. We call it the end of a section. We'd call that like a full cadence." He says, "Oh, that's cool. Right. All right, let's go on to the next thing." So when I look back at that experience of being a music tech teacher, it was a real epiphany. It was just such an epiphany. It was the best thing that happened to me in my life, in my teaching career, stepping out of my comfort zone and bracing myself for that, because in fact it is the future. It is what's going to happen. The other thing that I realized with the use of technology, and it's been so prominent in this IB program is the role of the teacher. And we are in a position now with education where students have the ability to gain, gather, and use knowledge faster than the rate a teacher can give the knowledge to them.
Right.
They can do this much faster. So our roles as teachers are not so much as teachers, more as mentors. And when young students, young aspiring music teachers come in, it's very important. It was very important for me to impart that to them. You have to be ready for this, because 5-10 years from now, this is what you're gonna do.
Yep.
We were taught this way. I said, well, now is the time to start learning.
Yeah. Bravo to you. That's really impressive. All of this, your curiosity and your openness and your willingness, because it takes a lot of time to take time out of your already overwhelmed schedule to then, on top of it, as you say, take some classes or spend a lot of time in front of your own computer trying to figure out how this stuff works. Bravo. It's a lot to ask of teachers, especially, you know, of teachers who are, you know, notably older than their students, right? You know, as opposed to a 20 something who's probably grown up with this stuff. And I mean, it is generational to some degree, not entirely. But I think that it's so interesting what you say about being mentors, because absolutely, kids have access now, thanks to the intertubes. They have access to everything. And one of the biggest problems, they don't yet have the critical thinking in place to understand whether what they're accessing is good information or not. And that's where we come in, is to be able to guide them. We can show them lots of stuff, lots of good stuff, but they're on top of it going to be discovering a gazillion things on their own. And what they really need in every aspect of their life, much less music, they need the tools internally to discern and decipher whether something is legit or not, or good or not, or in many cases, is it AI or not? I mean, that's the world now. It's like, did a human create this or did a computer? And what are the pros and cons of, you know, of all of this? I'm not the least bit anti-tech, but I am very pro understanding what you're looking at. And if tech is used, that it should be, you know, credited to what is creating the experience. You know, that's very, very important, not to mention consent and compensation and all those things for the artists that the tech, the AI is getting its work from. But that's a separate discussion. But back to the kids, being able to teach them by examples, even just taking time in the classroom to pull things up, yay or nay, to say, hey, let's type this in and see what comes up, and giving them object lessons. They need these skills desperately. Most adults don't have them. That's why we're in the pickle we're in. You know, that most adults believe anything that they see. First, it used to be they'd believe anything they read or saw on TV. Now they believe whatever, you know, the search engine, you know, throws up at them, which is mostly sponsored and biased things, until you get to the ninth, you know, thing on the list. And the lack of critical thinking is a disaster of education over a long period of time, but it is really an issue now more than ever because of that availability of information flying at these students at record pace.
Alex, do you have any thoughts on how we might be able to support young music teachers? You've mentioned being able to develop this skills of critical thinking, critical teaching in our program. Any thoughts, any more ideas about how we could better support music teachers keeping an open mind to embrace new ways of thinking and teaching about music?
The more conversation about it, the more interaction with music makers, right? The more we have a lot of advocacy programs, especially in the U.S., whether it's NAFME, the National Association for Music Education, or Music for All, or a bunch, a lot. I'm missing most of them, you know, just in the conversation. But there are a lot of advocacy organizations here, and I'm sure abroad, that are very helpful to teachers if they know where to look and to plug in and to be active with them and to get that support. Teachers do need support. It's overwhelming. As I said, you know, it's already a full schedule, and now we're asking them to ramp up in a very big way to be the absolute contemporaries of the people they're teaching, and to understand and maybe even be a step ahead of the people they're teaching, who have basically grown up zipping around iPads from the time they're one and a half, you know, so it's just a you know, their brains are wired differently than ours. I mean, it's really that simple. So any kind of support. I think from my perspective as a composer, I feel it's very effective. I do a lot of Zooms and I love what I call web rehearsals. I love them. And I think that's really effective to have people, have guests come into the classroom, the band room, the orchestra room, whatever it is, and interact with the students and interact with the teacher and offer support after the fact as well. Both the teachers and the students know that I am always available by email, to for any questions or help, and I stick by that. I think that's really important for those of us who are writing the music to make ourselves as available as possible and share information. People like me and other people, we'll put together website resources on websites. Jody Blackshaw, Rob Diemer, myself, a bunch of us have these ancillary auxiliary pages that list hundreds of links, whether it's for diversity or in my case, tech. I did a big presentation on AI and immersive media in music performance and education for CBDNA, for the composers at a regional CBDNA in Las Vegas a couple of months ago. And along with the big, multimedia presentation, I created a companion webpage of a gazillion links to get in many different categories to get people started, to give them a starting point because it is so overwhelming. And I think those kinds of things that anybody can do, it doesn't take that long. It just takes, a little time and thought to put something together that will give tools more readily and one-stop shopping to the very people that we're asking to A, perform our works and B, educate these kids. So it's our responsibility too. I'm not on faculty anywhere. I'm not a teacher or an educator, but I feel like I am one by default in that I choose to participate. And I would just say to all my peers who are writers, participate, become, an ersatz ad hoc teacher, because anything that you do is going to support our entire field.
Yeah.
Supporting the teachers is the mo is incredibly important. It's the most important thing.
What do you think sparks creativity and passion in music?
Curiosity. Curiosity, openness to everything. And that's again, that circles right back to what we started this conversation with about it comes really in a classroom setting, in a school setting. That comes usually from the top down, the example the teacher sets. If the teacher is sparked and curious and enthusiastic and maybe doesn't have all the answers, and that's okay, but hey, let's look at this and talk about it. What is this music coming from this, country you've never heard of? Let's listen to this. Whatever the thing is. I think that, kids learn from example and they see both positively and negatively, right? If they're lucky enough to have curious parents, that's all the better. But maybe they do or don't, but what we do with them in the classroom can certainly, take up some of that good space and bring something to them that they may not have had before. So I think that's what sparks creativity. It's internal. You can't teach somebody per se, creativity. I mean, either they kind of have it or they don't. You can't really teach somebody to be a great composer. You can give them tools, right? You can, say, here is counterpoint, here is motivic development, here are these things, these forms that in a, will get you through a piece, and here's how to use them. So, and we can teach theory, we can do all these things, but ultimately, either they have a good ear and that's connected to their heart, or they don't, right? And not everybody does, and that's okay. So you can't teach a lot of things, but you can encourage and you can model. And but by doing that, maybe they'll want to give things a shot. When I do Zooms with all these bands, every single time I say to all the students, whatever their age, I say, you're all good musicians. Each one of you can compose. And maybe some of you are already organizing sound in some ways, whether it's, improv or textural stuff and sound design or songwriting or jazz or full-on composed pieces, but I really want to make it clear to them that they are all capable. So if you tell them, and you know this so well, Jim, if you tell students that they are capable, if you give them that responsibility and that pat on the head that makes them feel good about themselves, they're probably going to see themselves that way. So it just takes encouragement and curiosity.
The more and more I walk into schools with consultations and workshops and so on, most often when you go into an international school, or especially an American school, an American international school, you see their traditional setup. You see band room, the choir room, orchestra room, and so on, some studios, some practice rooms, and so on. But more and more, what you're seeing is the independent music tech lab, the music creation lab, or the sound studio, or the recording studio, and so on. That used to be sort of a unique thing, I think, in schools. Now it's becoming more and more common. I guess where I'm leading with this is I see a lot of my colleagues in international schools trying to take these steps to merge technology and electronic music with, for lack of a better word, an old paradigm of the performing ensembles. And a lot of struggling, a lot of experimentation, a lot of not quite sure knowing where we're going, and that's absolutely perfectly fine. But I was just wondering whether or not you could share any thoughts as far as where you think this might be going or what teachers could be doing. Do you see any type of a future of a melding of electronic music with live performance, with acoustic music, for example, and how might that look in a school?
Absolutely. Well, since I've been doing electroacoustic pieces for about 15 years now, at a time when almost nobody was doing it. I think Stephen Bryant had Ecstatic Waters a year before I got onto the band scene, and then I did, without ever knowing Stephen, who's now a good friend, without knowing Stephen or his piece, I did this thing called Paper Cut for middle schoolers in 2010. So yeah, and you did Paper Cut, didn't you? Yeah. So, like, I was, and what has been so thrilling is I've been a real proselytizer, as any of my colleagues will say, that I've been encouraging everybody for all these years to write electroacoustic music. Come on, it's really fun. So I think part of it is, yes, as the writers themselves and the publishers, the independent publishers, much less the big ones, that have to really encourage more and more of this repertoire. But more to the point of what you're asking, Jim, is, I had done during the pandemic, we all learned a lot because for at least a year and a half, we were quarantined, at least a year, maybe a year and a half, depending on the area. And in quarantine, you had all these students and programs, music programs that still had to keep chugging forward somehow, some way, but from a big distance and in isolation, which is the absolute opposite of what it is to be in an ensemble. It couldn't have been a harder blow to music performance and students in music performance than being quarantined and having to just be, stuck in their room by themselves, practicing with no sense of are they in tune to anything else or not, no sense of the musicianship involved in playing with other humans. So that was the downside. But the upside was that they were in a room by themselves and they had a lot of time to practice and to play with the technology. And I took advantage of that. I created a curriculum called Putting the E in Ensemble. That was it's still used now that we're not in quarantine, but it was used by many schools during that period where, and this leads up to a direct answer to your question, what I had them doing. He's breaking these ensembles. Let's say if you had a band or an orchestra of, let's say 60 members, and you break them all down into small groups, subsets of maybe six people in a group, whether it could be homogeneous by instrument or it could be a total mashup, whatever you wanted to do. And then you ask them all, because remember, they're all at home, you ask them all to open up, let's say, Audacity, a free program cross platform. It doesn't cost anything, everybody can use it, and record themselves on their instrument playing an original motive that they wrote. It could be very short or longer, whatever they want to do, but something reasonably short, under a couple of lines. So, and then what do? They upload, each one in that group uploads their original motive to a place where they all have access to all six tracks from each other, and then they dump all those tracks into their DAW, digital audio workstation, whatever they're using, to put their tracks together, and they start composing with this original material. It's a group composition. Every composition is different, and the joy on their in their expressions and the whole process, it was filled with joy. Everybody was so amazed by the fact that they could compose and they could do this. They got an object lesson in motivic development and how to take information, and use it and modify it, because of course they could run things through processing, they could chop things up, all the wonderful tools we have digitally. And they ended up, so many of these students who had never composed before ended up with pieces that were really sophisticated. And by the way, and this is one of my favorite things, is if they did not, which most of them didn't, if they did not set any rules of we're going to be in A flat or something like that, they didn't set any guardrails for what tempo or what key tonal center they were going to be in. Guess what? If they all are delivering pieces that are in, let's say, out of six people, maybe in four different tonal centers, you end up with this amazingly beautiful chromatic wor sound world that they're all diving into and digging. That I guarantee you, knowing what young students tend to do, none of them, if left to their own devices to just hear, write a piece of music, none of them would have been in that chromatic sound world. You know, young people tend, I don't know why this is, but they really do tend to be tonally centered, most of them. And this was a great way of kicking everybody off their ass.
Do you think, just sorry to interrupt on that, but do you think that's sort of a Western idea or
Yeah, I think it's very Western. And so I'm dealing with America and Europe when I talk about, you know, young people being tonally centered. I would like to think that that's not the case, you know, in other cultures where they have a lot more to choose from and a lot many approaches, plus a lot more sophisticated rhythm. We really have very boring rhythm in the Western culture when you think about it. Everything is so plodding and straight. And I do my best to do a lot of meter changes and other things, including at the very beginning level, to, you know, knock people off the dime on that. But I tell you this, getting back to your question to wrap, put a bow around everything I'm saying is that what do I see for the future with tech and with live? It's both. It's not either or. It's absolutely both. Everybody will be that much more fluent and have that much faster internet speeds and fast computers, and they'll be all wearables and implants and stuff. It's not really going to be holding anything in your hand for too much longer. But the world is going to be this hopefully beautiful place where they have that many more tools available to them. Just the same way that when I'm writing an electroacoustic piece, I am writing for all the traditional instruments, and I treat the electronics as an equal and separate and additional section of the ensemble. And all I do is the same thing that I would do with any section, the violins or the you know, the woodwinds or whatever, they all have their sound. So my track is going to have its sound and create sounds that I can't get out of the instruments. It's just another tool. It's another sound. So that's how I see tech and audio, you know, in live music, in education and beyond, in performance, because multimedia and the uses of all this are going to be obviously more prevalent and easier for everybody to accomplish.
As you're talking, I'm reflecting on that time of COVID and how
Yeah.
it closed down and so on, and how we were desperate as music teachers because we couldn't do what we normally did,
Right.
and we were in the box of we've done it this way, so we have to continue to do it this
Right.
way. But as you're speaking, I'm thinking we had the same experience as well, is that it was a great time to inspire composition, to inspire creativity, to inspire new approaches to music. And in fact, what kids were making was absolutely incredible,
Right.
was amazing. And it just to take that point and to just say, if we could take some of the advantages of what we had to go through with COVID and revisit those and apply those now to our old mindset, we might be really going somewhere. You had to keep an open mind to survive.
That's right. And it gave them tools, by the way, that are necessary from the podium when you're rehearsing a piece. How about when you're writing a piece of music, especially the way I just described, you're understanding structure in a way that maybe as players they never paid attention to before. And now what I'm seeing is that conductors who went through all this now are talking much more about the structure of piece. They're kind of analyzing things in an overall way, in an even a more successful way, because students, if they're composing, they have this understanding. They're putting the conductor score up on a screen so that everybody can see the full score. I've never understood why you know, musicians by and large in band or orchestra only see their one part. That's crazy to me. As a composer, I have to see the entire thing. And if I were a player, I'd want to see the whole thing, like any chamber player, you know, might want to see the whole score. So you're giving them skill sets that they're going to carry with them. And what I found from conductors is they said, from now on, I'm going to be building in analysis and composition into my program, that I will make the time for it. And if that means one less piece on the program, you know, what, we don't have time to rehearse that seventh piece or whatever, fine, because they're understanding that the way they've traditionally been doing it, which has been kind of two-dimensional. I don't want to fault anybody, but it's more like, okay, it's the new semester, and we're going to plow through learning and rehearsing all these pieces, and then we're going to have a concert, right? And it's very goal-driven. And it's not, it's, and there are, you know, there are lots of listening exercises and tuning exercises, but the goal is always, and we're going to learn all this, play it really well, and then have the concert, as opposed to a much more, you know, in the moment goal of let's absorb what all this is. Let's be holistic about it, which is my preference because it's music. Yeah.
Schools are making progress in this direction. Do you see any changes or more stuck?
Well, I see from my perspective, because I'm on one edge of the spectrum, that anybody who's working with me, sure, I see that they're really open to that. I can't speak for what's going on in the greater world at all, because I'm not aware of it. I don't know. But I know that all the many, many conductors that I deal with are like you. I mean, they're totally open and curious and wanting to keep expanding everybody's skill sets and have a very open approach to genre, to tech, to all these things. And obviously diversity. Hey, they're working with me, so that's a good thing too. So it's, I only know what I'm seeing, but what I'm seeing is very positive. I think it just takes a long time to get people, as you said, out of their comfort zones. Understandably, teachers are overwhelmed. What they do is incredible, and to ask them to do more things is kind of hard. It's so.
What's on the musical horizon for you?
I think I'm in recovery right now. I just delivered two big pieces. I just delivered a electroacoustic band piece that's also very visual, as I like to do. It's got some physical elements to it. And I just delivered a professional level solo tuba electroacoustic piece that I'm very happy with. And that will get premiered in, it was commissioned by Gretchen Renshaw James, and she is premiering it at the International Women's Brass Conference in Japan, in Mito, Japan, in August. And at that point, I'm going to be sending it out into the world to a lot of tubists. And there were many commissioners on it as well. And I'm proud of the piece because it is extremely cross-genre. I mean, it starts in one place, goes to a totally different place that no one, I think, is expecting at all. And that makes me happy. Because it all makes sense motivically. Like it really makes sense. And I even include an analysis of it just to sort of prove my point. But it is all over the map. Like I take material and I start it in almost a 12-tone way. And then we go into a jazz ballad. And by the end, it sounds like, you know, if Hans Zimmer were an Alex Shapiro fan, or, you know, this might be what a score would sound like. So I'm doing that. And, you know, I have you know, things ahead, but one of the things, I have so many pieces in my catalog, and I am the publisher, and I have wonderful distributors like Hal Leonard and others, but I am also taking a step back to give myself a little more space so I can continue to take care of all these babies I've launched out into the world, you know, with my assistant. I've got a full-time assistant who's fabulous, Laura Kreider, and she is on it. You know, she's really great. And so I want to kind of team up with her a little bit more in the next few months to really make sure that the stuff that is out there, you know, that people know about, it's always a challenge because with composers, you know, we're always looking ahead, we're always writing the next piece. And when you're really in that zone, you know, there is the right brain hemisphere and the left brain hemisphere, and they are very different places. And the trick, of course, especially if you are running your own business as I do, is to have them both talking to each other interchangeably in real time. But really, when you're in the thick of writing a piece, it's very hard to shift gears, you know, into the admin. And so, giving yourself time to just be in the admin world for a little bit while the ideas percolate for the next piece. That's a good thing. Everybody needs space.
We're getting toward
Yeah.
the top of the hour, and so I just wanted to again say thanks. But before we do that, before we wrap things up, do you have any closing thoughts or words of wisdom for
For teachers,
teachers or teachers in?
teachers or students, yeah, the main thing is don't be afraid and take risks. Don't think you have to do things the way you were taught. Don't think you have to do things the way they quote unquote should be taught, or, you know, or consumed or learned, you know, if you're a student. The biggest joy in life is the unexpected, is being open to good things happening when you haven't planned it all out and when you don't quite know what you're doing. And I think we're in a society, at least in the West, that puts an awful lot of undue emphasis on success and, you know, being top of your game and goals and all of this. And I think it's quite out of whack. And I think it's really exacerbated by what students see on social media, because they see all the glamour and the glitz and all the things they should aspire to, right? And it's so damaging because it creates this sense of competition and wannabeism and a false ideal of what success is that, in my world and mind, has no bearing on a happy life or on reality, really. And it's gotten much worse than social media. I mean, there's nothing wrong with social media per se, but it can be very skewed depending on what you're surrounding yourself with on your feed. So anything that all of us can do to remind students that they are worthy as individuals and that who they are and what they have to say does matter, and that they have a voice that can also speak up for others. You don't have to be a certain age to be an activist, to speak up, to say, to talk about things like, let's say, diversity or whatever. It starts immediately. If you have a thinking brain, your words are welcome. And so there's that for the student side. And on the teacher side, it's that same thing of don't hold up models of what success looks like when there is no model for success. My definition of success is personal happiness. And you are successful when you're doing what you love to do. And we want to encourage students to find their passions, their joys, and to pursue them, whether they choose to do them as amateurs, loving it, but not making a living out of it, or as professionals. That's our job, is to help them find their passions and give them skill sets, while they're doing that. But that's my advice. I don't know if it's words of wisdom or not, but
My message to the listeners today, if you haven't had the opportunity to read some of her material or to listen to some of Alex's work, it'll change your life. You need to spend some time on this. And
thank you.
whether you're a band director or a choir director or a classroom music teacher or teaching composition, Alex has the foresight of looking at the future and paving the way for us to know what we need to prepare for to come. So please take the time and look at her stuff, look at her materials. Alex, on behalf of many of us here in the music world and music education world, I want to say thank you. You're an inspiration, continue to be. And we look forward to hearing your future works. So keep it coming.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I so appreciate this conversation with a kindred spirit, as you very much are. And it's just such a great conversation to have. Thank you so much for inviting me to share this with you.
It's been a privilege. It's been an honor. Thanks for inspiration. Okay. Thanks, Alex.